Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. In her new book, Year of the Monkey, musician and writer Patti Smith finds herself on New Year's Day in Santa Cruz, checking into the Dream Inn. Her original plan for that day was to have lunch at this secret nearby taco spot with her decades-long friend, music producer and journalist Sandy Pearlman, but that never happened. Sandy had suffered a cerebral hemorrhage and was in a coma. And so starts Smith's surreal and roaming year, which she details in her new memoir. The year is a lyrical time capsule of Smith's daydreams intermingling with the reality of her waking life leading into 2017. She records time with cafe visits, rides in cars with strangers, and of the time spent with playwright Sam Shepard helping him finish his final book. She also really captures the sort of anxiety across the country of that year, as well as many of her own feelings and her feelings of loss. As she writes in the book, in the epilogue, first Muhammad Ali died, then Sandy and Castro and Princess Leia and her mother. A lot of rough things happened, begetting things even more terrible. And then there was the future that came and went, and here we are still watching the same human movie, a long chain of deprivation playing out in real time on massive, perpetual screens. Heart-wrenching injustices constituting the new facts of life. The year of the monkey. The death of the last white rhinoceros. The ravaging of Puerto Rico. The massacre of school children. The disparaging words and actions against our immigrants. The orphaned Gaza Strip. And what of existence only a reach away? What of the stoic writer who held the miniature of the world in the palm of his tattooed hand? What will happen to him? I had asked myself, shuttling back and forth to Kentucky. When I first wrote these words, I didn't know yet. And one could fast forward or move backwards, but time has a way of still going, ticking away. New things one cannot alter, cannot get down fast enough. Patti Smith joins me in studio, and she will be at Barnes & Noble at Union Square tomorrow evening. Patti, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. That was a very nice reading.
Oh, great.
Aren't I there tonight? I think I'm...
Are you there tonight?
Yes.
Hey,
I'm signing books tonight.
Will you check the date on that just to make sure?
I've been in a few different cities in the past few days, but I'm sure that Barnes & Noble is tonight.
All right.
If it isn't, thanks for telling me.
Okay. We'll get that straightened out.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry.
No worries. But, have you... you know, I think a lot of people, when they read this book, will relate. People, when you've had one of those years... One of those years where a lot of stuff happens to you and around you. Had you had a year like 2016 before?
Oh, I've had worse years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that the country has had worse years in the past couple of decades, but you know, I suffered great loss in 1994. I lost my husband. He was only 45, and a month later I lost my brother, and he was 42. I had already lost my pianist and Robert Mapplethorpe, so I would say that 1994, ending as a widow, losing my brother, and having two young children, and not quite knowing what was next, that was probably my roughest year.
What was it that made you want to write about 2016?
Well, as you said, I mean, when you were talking about it, I thought I was going to begin 2016 with one of my oldest friends. I knew Sandy Pearlman for almost half a century, and we had lots of plans to go roaming around and just explore the beginning of the new year. And unexpectedly, he wound up in the ICU unconscious, and I was on my own. So I just kept going, and to keep myself company, I wrote. So that's what I did. I write every day, but when I'm alone, I write excessively.
I think it's interesting that your birthday is December 30th.
Yes.
So it, you know, coincides with the end of the year, when a lot of people are sort of reflecting about what the year was, what they want for the future. Has your birthday affected you in that way as well? Because it's not just...
Well, I realized that my birthday, when I was younger, was a little problematic because it's so close to Christmas, and being the oldest of four children, it was a birthday easily forgotten. And But I learned to look at my birthday sort of as a day to reflect what already happened and a day to project what would happen. And so I always have tried to do something useful on my birthday. Many, many years I've performed on my birthday. I did in the 70s in New York at the Palladium, in the 90s at the Bowery Ballroom, and in San Francisco at the Fillmore. And it's been exciting to play on my birthday. But the years I haven't, I usually spend reading and writing. So to do something constructive.
My guest is Patti Smith. The name of her book is The Year at the Monkey. Patti will be at Barnes & Noble tonight.
Okay. I was like, oh my gosh, what, am I that off of...
No. Apologies.
No, that's okay.
At the opening of your book quotes the poet and essayist who's known for the theater of cruelty, and the quote is, "A mortal folly comes over the world." Why did you start your book with this quote?
Well, it was... I added the quote toward as I was finishing it, because I mean I think the mortal folly for our country was having a person who was absolutely, I think, unqualified, and not a humanist, not empathetic, nor one who comprehends how important it is to be a guardian of the whole world as well as our people. So to have Donald Trump made president in the Year of the Monkey, to me, was our great American mortal folly.
The book begins with you checking in to the Dream Inn, which you remember is the Dream Motel. And the sign on the hotel, you have a conversation with this sign. And I just love the idea of the sign giving you signs.
Yes.
To go one way or another. How did that idea come about?
Well, I have such imagination. These things aren't ideas. They sort of semi-happen. You know, like mm-hmm. I'm staring at the sign and I have an imaginary conversation with the sign, I suppose. But it just happens simultaneously. And in fact, in the last book, M Train, I had a long conversation with the statue of Tesla that's in Midtown. And it's not unlike me to have conversations with one of Michelangelo's slaves or gravesite at a favorite poet. So why not a hotel sign?
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
I like this. There's this one line when you're talking about, as the sign's starting to have a conversation with you, you said, "Besides, once fully aroused, the brain is receptive to all kinds of signals, but I wasn't about to confess that to a sign."
Yeah,
about the sign.
I have my limitations of how far. I'm not going to be heckled by a sign, although I did get heckled in the book. But it's also, I think it's important. There are certain things in the book I have to, you know, deal with the decline of two of my mm-hmm. dearest friends and loss and the political state of our country, of the world. And I think we need to laugh. Comic relief is important. Even when I'm performing, one of my favorite things isn't, you know, applause or accolades. It's when I say something that strikes a chord and everybody starts laughing. And so I think levity is to weave levity within these sometimes tragic or mournful themes is important.
Are you a person who looks for signs?
They just come. I am superstitious about signs, but I've also trained myself to, if the signs, I don't like them, I'll steal myself to combat them. Mm-hmm. It's when I was young, I read this poem by James Joyce, and it has a line in it that says, "The signs that mock me as I go." So I always think about that. Some signs are taunting you and will steer you in the wrong direction. Other signs, it's prudent to follow and to be to acknowledge. So as we get older and make our mistakes, we start learning which signs are the best to embrace.
You have that intuition, or that where that gut feeling is actually experience, well, sort of tapping you on the shoulder.
Yeah, well, I think it's I think it's a combination of intuition and experience. Both are important.
My guest is Patti Smith. The name of her new memoir is The Year of the Monkey. Why The Year of the Monkey?
Well, because coincidentally, the book began. I wrote my first entry. The book is written in time, so the first entry was written January 1st, 2016, and soon after, unbeknownst to myself, I walked into the middle of festivities and I realized that it was the Year of the Monkey. And I was a little concerned about that because the monkey is a mischievous sign. It's energetic but mischievous, and I had a lot on my mind. I had a friend in the hospital. I had another friend who was battling ALS. I was approaching 70. The election year was unfolding in a strange way. So I was thinking that the monkey was indeed mischievous, and it's a year long, and it sort of begins as the ushering into the Year of the Monkey and ending as the year ends, and around the time of the inauguration.
And when I was called the Year of the Monkey, of course, I went researching about the Year of the Monkey, and one of the traits, the health traits, is mental stress, which I don't know if you knew or not.
Well,
does that seem appropriate for you for that?
Well, I try really to balance, mental and physical strength, with strength, and also to be in good health and to, sort of talk or walk myself out of stress, because stress, I learned, is its own physical deterrent. People suffer more ailments due to stress than they realize. So it's very important to somehow find a way to balance the stress that comes upon us.
Are you someone who can meditate?
No, I'm not a good meditator because my brain is like a jumping bean and it seldom sleeps. So for me to meditate, it's like I'll just sit there and hear like a cacophony of voices. So no, I'm not a good meditator.
Somehow I knew that was the answer.
But I think it's a wonderful thing. I'm just not good at it.
You have a lot. Your brain is big and moves a lot, I can tell. You mentioned writing on your own and writing solo and something that you do on your birthday sometimes. When do you do your best writing and where? Do you have a spot you go to? Is it on napkins and coffee shops?
Well, I like to write in the morning. When I was younger, of course, I loved to sit up all night and write, and I could write whenever I wanted. I had a day job and I would write at night. But then when I got married and had children, I had less time to indulge sitting up all night writing. So I taught myself to get up at 5 in the morning and while everyone was sleeping, and 5 to 8 was my writing time. And at first it was a challenge, but I did develop a daily discipline, a daily practice for writing in the morning. And even though now my children are grown, I still do it. I like to write in the morning. I like to write when I have my first coffee. I love to write I like to write in public places that are sort of like low key, like an empty cafe, an empty train. I don't necessarily want to have my own space to write. I'd like to write while I'm on the move, but where you have solitude in the midst of action.
I also think for mornings, I like to write in the morning too, is that the day is new, nothing's come in to your brain, nobody's intruded.
Right.
It's just fresh.
Yeah.
And there's possibility.
It's just, and sometimes dreams, because sometimes a dream that one has filters through the writing, or you might have an extraordinary dream to get down, and in writing that, it evolves into something else. So yeah, it's a good time to write.
My guest is Patti Smith. The name of her book is The Year of the Monkey. Patti will be at Barnes & Noble in Union Square tonight. We'll have more with Patti after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Patti Smith. We're talking about her new memoir, Year of the Monkey. So the very important person to you in your life was Sandy Pearlman, who was your friend. People who are music people will recognize him as a longtime producer of Blue Oyster Cult. He produced, I think, The Clash at one point. Mm-hmm. He was a professor too, right?
Yes, he was.
That's the resume stuff. How do you describe Sandy when you think about Sandy?
Well, I met Sam. He was born in Stony Brook, went to college in Stony Brook. He was a brilliant, very speedily brilliant. When you talk about jumping beans of the mind, you know, he was just, he was a prodigy. Mm-hmm. And he wrote beautiful pieces about rock and roll in the late 60s. And one of our great rock writers, and then he became a producer and a songwriter. And I met Sandy in 1971. He came to my very first performance at St. Mark's Church, and it's sort of interesting that these two men, him and Sam Shepard, are both featured in the book, both having afflictions, because I was with Sam. Sam was my boyfriend at the time, and I did my performance. And afterwards, Sandy Pearlman came up to me. He loved Jim Morrison. He used to dress like Jim Morrison, and he just had such a great way about him. And he came up and told me that I should be fronting a rock band. Now, I was working in a bookstore. I was just doing my first poetry reading, and I thought it was really funny. And he said, you know, why don't you come and maybe you could sing with the band I'm producing? And I just laughed and said, you know, I have a good job at a bookstore. And I told Sam about it, and I thought it was really funny. And Sam looked at me and he said, you know, you could do that. You could do anything. And but I never thought I would. But Sandy kept pursuing me about this. And eventually, of course, I did form a rock band, but more organically, mm-hmm. and recorded in 75. And Sandy was always in our corner. And that's why he was on his way to the Fillmore to see us, but he never made it.
It sounded, from that, just that description of Sam and Sandy, they sound like they were just really good friends.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Sandy was never my boyfriend. He was always my friend. Sam and I went through various aspects of a relationship, but we were friends, number one. We weren't going to sacrifice friendship, you know, if the romance part wasn't, you know, the right thing. We stayed friends always, and he was awesome. I just loved him.
And you were working with him on his final book.
Yes, on his last two books. Ooh. And which I wrote about, and mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he didn't really need assistance in, you know, the mental writing of the book, but the physical act and editing, the physical act became problematic because of the nature of ALS, where mm-hmm. you lose the use of your hands and things like that, but also just to be together and talk about the book and talk about what he was doing and what he was thinking of. And we had written before. We had written Cowboy Mouth together. We wrote mm-hmm. some of my earliest songs I wrote with Sam for his earlier plays. So, you know, we were no stranger to working together.
My guest is Patti Smith. The name of her new memoir is The Year of the Monkey. There are moments in the memoir when you're speaking to a man named Ernest, E-R-N-E-S-T. And you can ask him, you're not a hologram, are you? And you have these interesting conversations with Ernest. First of all, I just have to ask, because there's so much sort of daydreaming in the book mm-hmm. and reality. Was there an Ernest?
Well, Ernest is, you know, I can't really speak about Ernest. That is really something that people, because everything is revealed about Ernest by the end. So I'm not going to reveal that myself. People will find out about Ernest. But one of my favorite fellas that moves in and out of the book. But I can only say this. I believe if I write, I mean, I wrote M Train. This is really sort of it's a very light sister to M Train. It's almost like it's a diptych. Mm-hmm. And someday I'm going to write a third one, and I'm sure Ernest will return.
In the book, I'm curious about, how would you describe your relationship with technology? Because your phone is often not charged, and you're leaving chargers plugged into walls. Like,
yeah, well, I'm not great with technology, but I can do what I can do really well. Like, you know, it took me a long time to figure out how to use the phone and get used to it. It's still a foreign idea to me. A phone was like a phone booth. You went to the phone booth to make a phone call, and, you know, it's just, we suffer phone abuse now. I mean, I remember as a teen, I was never allowed to use a telephone when I was growing up because it costs money, and unless, you know, until you were 16, you weren't even allowed to touch the phone. And, you know, it's a very foreign idea for me still that we are so readily available and connected by the telephone. But I have learned, my daughter, for instance, taught me how to make an Instagram on the telephone. So I found it very useful in posting my Instagram and, you know, sometimes taking pictures and, of course, talking to my kids. But I'm not, I like also testing myself. I do it sometimes. I'll like say, okay, I'm going to leave the phone here. I'm not going to take it with me. I'm not going to, you know, just because I think it's important to move and maneuver through a couple of days without it. But at that point in 2016, I was phone free for quite a while.
You are good at Instagram, and you seem to enjoy it. If you don't follow Patty on Instagram, go follow Patty Smith on Instagram. It's just very joyous in many
ways.
Well,
it's I think of it as like it's in some ways it's a cultural public service. You know, with you know, I've also learned on Instagram people like to see pictures of you, so I'll, you know, every once in a while take a self picture or, you know, find a cool picture because. But I also try to share books that I think are really great, films that I think are great, people that are doing important things. My daughter Jessie has a climate change nonprofit called Pathway to Paris, so I will post things about that. When Greta Thunberg was here, well, not just here, everywhere. In the world. You know, I'm supportive of her, and so, but it's a positive site. And sometimes people take, they think it's not right if I get rid of certain things people say, if they're just too abusive or, you know, they, but, you know, I just tell them, my site isn't about freedom of speech. It's a cultural exchange, and it's like I'm not. If you want to like have these kind of arguments, go to all the 9 million other places you can go to be abusive. But I'm not putting up with it.
It's very beautifully curated.
Thanks.
As long as we're talking joy, because there's sadness and loss in the book, but I don't want people to think that it's just that. There's a lot of joy. And one of my favorite chapters is called Why Belinda Carlisle Matters. And there are two things I love about this chapter. One, we learn about your love of libraries.
Yes.
As a kid in New Jersey.
Always. And the New York Public Library is awesome. One of the greatest libraries in America.
What did you love about libraries as a kid? What did they really do for young Patty Smith?
Well, I grew up in a rural area of South Jersey. I did live in Philadelphia, but then we went to South Jersey, and it was there was no real cultural touchstones there. We didn't have a good library locally. We didn't have any places really to go. So a couple of miles up, there was a library. It was my only, the only place where I could find all kinds of books. My parents didn't have much money, so we couldn't buy books. So I could walk up to take a trek up to the public library and get a treasure trove of all the books I dreamed of reading. I mean, to me, it was like, you know, finding Ali Baba's cave, you know, to see all of these books about everything I could imagine. So yeah, I've always loved and been grateful for libraries.
And the second part is we get to see a little bit of the signs in action a little bit. I'm going to ask you to read this, the last bit of Why Belinda Carlisle Matters. We learn why in the last couple of pages.
Okay. All right. I was in Seattle, and I went to this place called the Mission. I just wanted to get the name of the place where I go. Oh, I saw it. It's called the Bread of Life Mission. Sorry. So I was in Seattle, and I was going to the Bread of Life Mission to leave a donation. And a homeless fella in a long gray overcoat and purple watch cap was scrawling a message on a brick wall with a thick piece of pink chalk. I slipped a five in his cup next to a makeshift bed of flattened cardboard, then watched his fingers as the words slowly emerged. Belinda Carlisle matters. Why, I asked, why does Belinda Carlisle matter? He stared at me for fairly a long time that extended an even longer time, all the way back to when cities were merely hills. He shifted his gaze from me to over his shoulder, then down to his shoes, then finally looked up and answered in a low voice, "She's got the beat." This was a true Sandy moment. Had he been here, he would have surely declared this a momentous truth. I merely smiled and shrugged. I didn't doubt him, but I didn't put much stock in it either. Until several days later, back in New York City, unable to sleep, I was scrolling the channels and stopped at some music infomercial. I think it was one of those deals where they sell 22 CDs from the 80s, or maybe it was just girl groups. But there on the TV were the Go-Go's doing We Got the Beat on some English pop show. All the girls were cool, but it was Belinda who had the moves. Nothing flashy, kind of beach blanket bingo with a modern swing and a bit of French Paradis. Leggings, little high heels. Yeah, Belinda, I said aloud, you got the beat. Her exuberance was infectious. I imagined a nonviolent hubris spreading across the land, like the boys in West Side Story, buoyed by a mounting swagger, singing When You're a Jet. Hundreds of thousands of girls and boys flooding the open perimeter, taking on Belinda Carlisle's moves, singing We Got the Beat. And soldiers laying down their arms, and sailors leaving their posts, and thieves the scene of their crimes, and all at once we're in the epicenter of one grand musical. No power, no race, no religion, no apologies. And with this vast spectacle racing through my head, some part of me leapt up and sashayed down the road, entering the scene, joining the chorus, increasing ad infinitum, like William Blake's angels streaming from the turning pages of the Book of Life.
That is from Year of the Monkey by Patti Smith. Patti will be at Union Square Barnes & Noble tonight. Before I let you go, I did want to ask you one question about Robert Mapplethorpe.
Sure.
Because this is a big year. There's been the Guggenheim retrospective, and there's been the dance piece, the triptych at BAM, and the movie with Matt Smith.
Oh, no, you can't include the movie.
Don't include the movie? Okay.
Only because it's a very bad movie.
Movie
aside. So let's not include that in the accolades for Robert. if you don't mind. Well, you can do what you want, but I can't agree with you.
No worries. I want to know what you want people to remember about him. That was my question, was going to be like, never mind all the other things. What is it that you want people to know and remember about him?
Well, the reason I wrote Just Kids was so that people could get a window into Robert's process and how much he struggled as a young man, how much he sacrificed for his work, how he evolved, and what kind of person he was when I knew him. He was generous, he was kind, he was supportive, he had a strong work ethic. And, you know, I think Robert asked me to write this book because I think, sadly, dying at 42, he anticipated that he might only be remembered as being, you know, an artist who had AIDS and took very groundbreaking pictures, and then that would be it. He was hoping to be more, that people would understand more about him. And since I knew him at such a young age, mm-hmm. I could share that with everyone. So everything I want people to remember is within the book. And I think the proof of all of the positive things that I've written about him is right in the work. He did push the envelope. He did do things that no one had done, but he also produced works of great beauty. He had so many other ideas. I mean, had he lived with his work ethic, he would have had a tremendous body of evolving work. So I'd like people to remember that he did great work, that he was a visionary, but he died quite young before he could realize completely his vision. And plus, he was also really funny. He had a beautiful sense of humor. So remember Robert's work. Remember that lopsided grin of his.
Year of the Monkey is the name of the memoir. Patti Smith will be at Union Square, Barnes & Noble tonight. Patti, thank you so much for spending with us today.
You're awesome. Sorry that I objected about the film, but I have bad history with it.
So. Oh, I'm sorry that I didn't realize that.
No, that's okay.
But you got to say what you got to say, which is always important. You have to say the truth.
Well, I just...
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.